for the last 5-7 days. It's been hot, abysmally hot, humid, very tropical here. I call it the Florida of the North. If you've ever longed to live in Florida, you live in a tri-state area, well, your dream has come true without actually having to relocate, get new license plates, change your driver's license. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Of course, we are on Facebook Live. Go to our page, Progressive Radio Network, and you'll see the live video feed. You'll want to do that because, number one, it enhances the experience, right? And you always want an enhanced experience. Number two, you get to see our second guest today. His name is Max Gomez, a top amateur motocross racer whose life changed forever during the course of one jump. You're going to meet him in a few minutes once he finds a parking spot, which could be, who knows how long that'll take. You're going to meet Michelle Leonard. She's the founder of Soulsational Music and Wellness Festival, an incredible festival in its 8th year. It's all about community. It's all about love, life, hugs, and great free rock and roll this Saturday, 28th, in Bayville, New Jersey. Incredible. I hosted it last year and have the honor of hosting it again. And it's probably one of the best festivals I've gone to in the last, 5 years or so. So that says a lot. And it's free. All sponsor-driven, which we love about that. So I want to talk to you about a few things that are very prevalent and important to convey. One of them is I'm really happy about this. If you know anybody who's deaf or hard of hearing, please make sure you inform them of this because this is huge. Starbucks is to open the first U.S. store that has signing staff. That means they will speak American Sign Language. Isn't that amazing? This is going to take place in October in Washington, D.C. Now, it's a great PR move. It's a great clientele customer move for Starbucks. So good move. And not only that, logistically, they picked D.C., which obviously is a dense city, but they picked it near a top prominent private university for the deaf and hard of hearing. Well, that makes complete sense, right? When I imagine they're sitting around a table going, all right, well, where should we open one of these? It's not going to be in Boise, Idaho. It's going to be in New York, San Francisco, Boston, Chicago. So this is a great location, and it's going to be staffed with 20 to 25 employees. Of course, all the employees are going to be students, of course, of this private university for the deaf and hard of hearing. And I think this is really significant on many levels because, number one, they can really serve their captive clientele. I don't know how big this university is, but a university, I think, by definition, is above 200,000 or 300,000. I believe, in terms of enrollments. And also, it's a tremendous model for executives from corporate America and retail chains to follow. Because here we are, 2018, and yes, we've made some tremendous progress. It seems like every month I'm seeing different commercials on the air. I saw one the other day, and I forget the product, but someone was in a wheelchair. And it's becoming more commonplace. And I love that. You know, obviously, I embrace diversity, inclusion. I spoke to last night a group of really, really astute high school kids, part of a state police program. And it's called the Explorers Club Police Athletic League. And they were so impressive. And I was just taken by their knowledge, their interest, and obviously their fortitude in learning something so young and becoming part of the law enforcement at such a young age. But I spoke to them about inclusivity, the importance of diversity, and I said, if you become a law enforcement officer, you may pull someone over that has mental health issues, maybe bipolar disorder, maybe manic, maybe suicidal. I mean, all these things are possible when you pull someone over. So I was obviously explaining to them the warning signs so they, as an officer of the law, can understand these because there's actually organizations out there for police officers like Cop to Cop, Cop COP, the number two COP, where cops can speak freely to each other and not worry about the backlash of carrying a gun and a badge, but being perceived as weak. That's very commonplace, I'm sure, as you well know, in that particular field, more so than any other field because it's about bravado. So going back to the kind of the advancement and the awareness our marketplace has been experiencing lately, I really embrace it. And I take my hat off to Starbucks, and I'm sure it'll do well because obviously they opened it in a very smart part of D.C. I mean, they have a built-in clientele. They might as well have just opened a Starbucks right in like the student center of this university because they're just going to flock to there and hang out. I mean, can you imagine being deaf or hard of hearing and you're in college? And there's an announcement like a few blocks away that a Starbucks or a coffee bar is going to be opening. And then you realize, wow, I can totally, this is going to be my new hang because you don't have to worry about going to another local coffee shop. And this possibly may be the case where someone does know how to sign or lip readers or et cetera at a local coffee shop. But overall, it's not that common. So here is a student who gets to go and obviously chug down some Joe while they're trying to study. You know, keep awake, keep those credits churning away, keep your eyelids open, and you can hang out in a convivial atmosphere that's been catered to you. That's big. That's really, really huge. Now, I can really relate because if they ever opened, I won't say Starbucks because I'm not a coffee drinker. What fast food chain do I really like? All right, well, here's the deal. Here's my example. If I go to like a Panera or any restaurant like that, that's the only kind of fast food place I go to. If I go to McDonald's, I'll have fries. I took my kids the other day and I got fries. That's as far as I'll go. I haven't had a hamburger from McDonald's or any of those places in 25, 30 years. You believe that? 25 or 30 years, I have not consumed a hamburger from one of those places. Because if you do, it probably stays in you for 25 or 30 years. Anyway, so the parallel I'm trying to draw is if, say, Panera Bread had a gargantuan size menu on their wall that I could read. I can't read any restaurant menu that is a fast food restaurant. I mean, McDonald's, of course, I know what they have. Burger King, you know, Whoppers, fries, Coke, whatever, you know, the general stuff. If you go to a restaurant, well, Mama always said, don't order off menus with pictures on the menu, right? But anyway, that would be the parallel for me. If I went into a Panera Bread and the menu is so huge because I can't read it. I always have the same thing every time because I know what it is. It's a turkey sandwich with avocado. And I always say to the person, oh, you know, I forgot my glasses. It's a half a sandwich, turkey and avocado. I forget the name. You know, they're like BLT. I'm like, yeah, okay, without the B. I'll take the L and the T and the O or A for avocado. But anyway, that would be the parallel for me. So I get it to be in an environment that works so well. So again, great job, Starbucks. Very, very cool. I want to talk about Demi Lovato real quick. Demi Lovato is obviously a top pop singer. Came out a few years ago. She announced that her battle with depression and anxiety is pretty prevalent, and she's been working hard to fight against her addiction, drug and alcohol as well. And for the last 6 years, she's been sober until about, I believe it is springtime. And unfortunately, earlier this week on Tuesday morning, she had to be taken to the hospital for a drug overdose. And she's faring well, according to sources that are reporting in the paper and online. But it's sad because there are so many things that are plaguing her. She's back using drugs. She's off the wagon. She's drinking. She has depression and anxiety. Okay, if you're keeping track, I think that's four. And an eating disorder. So that is a huge, huge laundry list of major issues to combat. Now, I remember the last time I talked about Demi Lovato on a show was when she said she was not going to continue her career in music. And I don't know what happened. And I couldn't find anything online to substantiate what she did or what she said and how she changed her mind. Because with all this going on, I mean, that's a lot. First of all, if you're not in the limelight, that is a gargantuan amount of personal issues to be dealing with. Alcohol, drugs, depression, mental health issues, mental health. That is huge. You have to be in therapy, multiple forms of therapy, group therapy, individual therapy. And it takes time. So the pressures of going on the road, she canceled her South American tour in the spring and citing production issues. But I'm sure it was related to personal health issues. And who could blame her? As a matter of fact, if you have tickets for this Thursday night show, tonight show in Atlantic City, you're not going. Well, if you go, you can go, but you're not going to see Demi Lovato. Have a good time. You can check out the new Hard Rock Hotel. Or stay at the former Revel Hotel, which is some really lame name like Ocean Front Resort or something like that. Like, they couldn't come up with a better name. Anyway, I digress. So there's so many different issues she has to overcome. And it's really difficult. And I feel sad for her. I feel bad for her. Eating disorder, cocaine. Oh, my God. Alcohol. She was clean for 6 years. That's a long time. And so if you have all this baggage, all this weight that you're carrying around, it's got to be really, really difficult to pursue a career. I mean, she's Grammy nominated. She's actually won Grammys. So I'm sure she's got major, major record pressure and performance pressure to do her tour on the road, etc. So we wish Demi Lovato all the best because, you know, I can't imagine how arduous it would be for her to make a comeback. And of course, you know, when you're it's like when an athlete gets hurt, you know, it's bad when the agent is at the hospital, right? Because the agent knows something's really, really bad. Contracts are going to be broken, et cetera. Things are going to have to be renegotiated, whatever the case may be. And now with Demi on the sidelines, this is not a quick fix. This is not, okay, we got dehydrated, pump her with some fluids, IV, she'll be back on the road in 3 or 4 days. No. It's going to take longer than that. Going to take a lot of intensive therapy, a lot of soul searching, a lot of downtime. And I hope the fans and social media, I hope, would be a little bit more empathetic. The stuff you see online is just really, really callous. And these are, I imagine, people who've never, ever experienced anything like mental health issues, addiction, eating disorders. Walk the walk, and then see what you have to say. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. It is Thursday, my favorite day of the week, and I'm happy to bring to the show Michelle Leonard. Michelle Leonard is the founder of the 8th Annual Soulstational Music and Wellness Festival, and I'm happy to have her on the phone right now because she's actually at the site in Bayville, New Jersey right now, Veterans Park, marking the field so people and vendors know where they're going this coming Saturday at 11 a.m. Michelle, how are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much, Mark, for having me today.
You sound so wide awake and effervescent, as always.
I try my best.
Tell me about the inception of the Soulstational. Number one, I love the name and what it stands for. You know, a celebration of life, love, and community. I mean, I totally agree, and I thank you for allowing me to host this for a second year in a row because it's emblematic of everything that certainly you stand for, and I share those same appreciations as well.
Yes, I actually really enjoy spending the time with you because I know that we think the same way and we want to touch the community and really reach out to, you know, let people find what makes them feel happy and healthy. So Soulstational started 8 years ago. We were just one day decided that, hey, this community needs something that is so just great and all about positive living. There's healthy, there's wellness. It's all about community, bringing them together. It's a good place for the kids to come because there's so much for them to do, and it's free.
Absolutely free. And you expect a free event, okay, to have a few bouncy houses, some giveaways, some frisbees, some lollipops, some pens, etc. But this festival really rocks. I was blown away by the caliber of acts last year, by the yoga instruction, by all the wellness professionals that were there. And there's so much hand stuff and free advice, of course, and there's organic food trucks. Are you kidding me? I never knew organic and food truck could be in the same sentence.
Yes, and it's just so wonderful. We have two stages of music, and it is free. Like we said, there's so much to do for free. From the time the gates open to the time the gates close, There's classes in three different areas for the kids to play. I mean, paint a shell, Twister. You know, we have yoga all day. There's just so many classes. I think we're hitting about 33 different classes you could take during the day.
Wow, that's incredible. It's nice to see that the community really comes together and embraces, because obviously there's so much for everyone, whatever your taste is. If you're a rocker, if you just love live music, I mean, especially when you are attracting and you've garnished the best top live bands touring in the New Jersey Shore circuit. I mean, that's incredible. So kudos to you on that front alone.
Yeah. And they want to be part of this. We're showcasing art. We're showcasing music. We're showcasing poetry.
Yeah.
There's so many different aspects to the festival to highlight, especially the Jersey Shore area is full of just talent that is amazing. And to just give them a grand stage with a grand amount of, you know, like the sound system alone, it's a concert. We're giving them a full
absolutely. Concert. Well, as a audio engineer, I am, you know, sometimes I can be an audio snob and picky about sound. And I went up to the sound guys like 30 minutes into it, because I had been talking to them, obviously, you know, talking about, you know, what's going to happen, the production values, et cetera. And I said to them, guys, I just want to say, number one, the sound, the audio system is great, but your mix is spot on. So a lot of people wouldn't pick up on that, but it does make a huge difference in terms of just a fluid and just, you know, colorful experience when it's spot on like that.
Yes, it's just amazing. And I gotta tell you, I just really love how people come together. Like, we have a massive amount of people that come out and do all of this on their own time for free. It's not one or two, it's like 100 something people, between volunteers, between all the people that are teaching these classes. It's just amazing amount of people coming out to support a good thing for the community.
Absolutely. And number one, I should tell people that you are not an event planner or production person, that you've become one, because this is such a large undertaking that this is probably a 10-month out of the year event building process, even just to the PR and marketing, the assembling of the vendors of all the bands, the over, how many, 10 bands or so?
We have 12 bands and musicians. Yeah, 12 bands and musicians, not to mention the poetry. We didn't even mention the demos. All these people are coming out to do their demos from their karate classes and their dance classes. These kids are having a blast.
And a kid talent show.
Oh, we have a full talent show. It's just walk in, you have a good time, and we have that going on this year, which is phenomenal.
And my favorite.
Family.
And my favorite, free hugs.
Oh, yes, and we do all free hugs all day.
Actually,
long.
Only topped by a drum circle at the conclusion of the day. Oh, that, for me, is the, that's the highlight.
I mean, you could go through, like, there's so much to mention. There's so many different aspects of this festival. It's like coming to literally almost like a circus, although we don't have the circus animals. You know, we have all these people that are in so many different areas showcasing so many good things that could bring somebody happiness, wellness,
it is
health.
It is kind of a combination, a melange of like a Woodstock meets like a wellness festival meets like, you know, an organic and food, you know, bevy of options, and you name it. It's just a great, great
food
experience.
Trucks. And that, amazing food trucks. It smells good here all day long.
Yeah, so if you're looking for fried Oreos, it's not the place for you to hang out.
No, but we definitely have enough of the festival family favorites that people may enjoy.
So talk about your background. What is your degree in hypnosis?
Yeah, so I'm a hypnotist, and that's just what I do full time. I absolutely love my job. I love to help people. I work pretty clinical and in the medical field, and I do a lot with labor and delivery. So that's my full-time job, and this is just my volunteer passion project. And,
What initially drew you to the a world of tapping and connecting into people through hypnosis? Because that's obviously specialty and a real niche.
Yes, it actually is. And I can just tell you a story briefly, but I actually received hypnosis as a child. So I was very, very sick as a kid, and I was legally blind and paralyzed from the age of 12 to 22. And hypnosis was actually one of my therapies at Children's Specialized Hospital and in Shriners. That's where I learned about it.
Wow.
And as I grew older, and I just wanted to share that gift of positive viewpoints with others.
Fascinating.
That there is a way to get through, that we can move towards that light of feeling well and being the best we can be, even if we have a disability or if we have a challenge.
Yeah, and
even
which we all do.
Feel the same. Everybody has a challenge somewhere.
And I was speaking to a group of kids last night, I was talking about how you never know what kind of battle someone is facing, whether they're an adult, teenager, or child. I mean, it may not seem consequential or, you know, vital to you, but to them, it's, you know, whatever is huge in their world takes a toll on you, and you can't devalue someone's feelings.
Absolutely not. And everyone's feelings are of value. So, I talk a lot about feelings all the time.
Well, it makes complete sense now that I understand how you could be such an avid proponent of health and wellness, because obviously it played a vital role in your childhood and obviously becoming healthier and staying healthy and obviously just not forgetting it and putting it behind you and be like, okay, I'm glad that chapter of my life is over, but feeling okay, well, you know what? There are other people out there experiencing maybe similar things, but, you know, maybe cancer, maybe depression, maybe, you know,
absolutely,
an oodle of diagnostic and diagnosable diseases that sometimes don't have the best cures or medicines.
Exactly. And we can take those challenges and then we could use them for positive things for other people. That's what I do.
Absolutely. And you're doing it in this form. Soulsational Music and Wellness Festival happening this Saturday in Babel, New Jersey. Yep, this Saturday. And it's what? Like a stone's throw from the ocean. It's about...
Literally.
50 miles south of New York City. It is free. I'm sorry, did I mention that? It is free. It's an incredible event. For more information, log on to soulsational.info. Soulsational.info. And what is your favorite part, or maybe two favorite parts of the day?
My two favorite parts.
When the beer tent opens?
Yeah, well, that's always good, too. But I have to say, very on my game. But you know what I really like? I love the drum circle when it starts to wind down, when I can finally just take a moment to breathe. That's pretty nice, actually. So I really like that time of day. But I love to actually, then the next day, when it's really quiet, when I have to come clean, because I actually do all the hard work myself, and I come clean the park. And I like to sit with the mandala that they created during the day.
Wow.
And it's kind of just nice because the park is clean. It's really quiet. And that whole mandala that was created by the attendees is just a beautiful piece of artwork for the next day.
That is really, that's pretty moving. I mean, I'm not trying to get too deep here, but, you know, I imagine, you know, it's kind of like you build it, they will come, you build it. All this 10 months of time, you know, a labor of love, the event happens and all these thousands of people come in. And it winds down with the drum circle. And last year, the sun was setting. It was really, really cool. And this year, my son is definitely going to be part of the drum circle. Last year, he wasn't taking drum lessons. He's going to be jamming. He's going to probably be the instructor. Anyway, and then, so it's the calm after the storm. It's something that you can bask in. Of course, not everybody can appreciate that because obviously they're going for, you know, the hiatus. Right. Not the hiatus, the high part of Soulsational, which is great.
And then I get really excited because I start again.
Yes.
Exactly. And every time we just do it better and better. We're totally organically grown. So it's been, growing slowly and moving forward. And like I said, we're not event planners. We are actually, most of us are moms and dads. We have small businesses. There's nobody here. There's no staff. I am the staff. I that's it. I do it all.
I have to. Have to disagree with you. You are an event planner. I have emceed and hosted many, many events, and I've never received a run of show as thorough. I mean, and not only is it thorough, it is, you know, it's 7-8 hour, kind of a 7 hour event, actually maybe even 8 hours because you start at 11 a.m.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many pages it is, 10, 15 pages of run of show. Of course, it's hosting information. It's a lot. But I mean, obviously, you never get that much thoroughness with that. So my hat off to you on many, many levels. Michelle Leonard, founder of Soulsational Music and Wellness Festival this Saturday, Bayville, New Jersey, Veterans Park, absolutely free, soulsational.info. Michelle,
thank you, Mark.
Have fun marking those fields.
Thank you very much. It's hot, but it's worth it.
It's hot, of course, and it's going to be hotter on Saturday when those bands start kicking out.
It's going to be great.
Take care. Enjoy.
Thank
See you
so
Saturday.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
My pleasure. Enjoy.
Right,
this is
bye-bye.
Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. If you are not online, definitely go over to the whatever your browser is. Open up Facebook. and log on to our Facebook page, the Progressive Radio Network, because our next guest is pretty incredible. Max Gomez, I can't say he learned to ride a motorcycle before he learned to walk, but it wouldn't be that much of a stretch of an imagination. Max is a motocross racer, and a phenomenal guy. And his life changed back in, when he was 18 in 2012, in a different direction. It didn't redefine him, but it redefined what his mission was in life. Max Gomez, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Happy to be here.
You got a parking spot.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a zoo out there, but I managed to finesse my way into a little lot. So
It's New York City, my friend.
Yeah.
It's a zoo of the world, right?
Yeah. You would think I live 20 minutes away. I'd have it figured out by now, but it...
No. Well, you're originally from Westchester.
Yeah. I actually, that's where we still have the house there. We're actually looking to sell that house and move to somewhere in Jersey. I think my parents like Freehold, but... originally from New York. I went to high school in New York, and that's pretty much where I was raised.
Bruce's house where he grew up just sold about 2 weeks ago, so otherwise you could have purchased that.
Yeah.
So now if your house does sell because of this broadcast, we get a piece of the pie. Because you just announced that you're, selling a house 20 minutes from New York City on an international network, so I imagine it will sell. So Max, what was the first thing that actually drew you to motorcycles?
So my dad was always, a motor type of guy where he liked cars, he liked bikes, jet skis.
Fast things.
Yes. Adrenaline junkie, kind of runs in the family. So, I remember, for my fourth birthday, the first bike that he had gotten me was a PW50, fairly small bike, pretty much the smallest bike you're going to get. It kind of just started as something that we did together, and we would ride around the park by my house, and that was kind of a daily thing. And before long, it was just, I was getting too big for the bike, so we stepped it up with a bigger bike, and then I was going too fast for the park, so we decided to take it to the motocross track, and then that's when things started to kind of grow from there.
Talk about that experience when you transitioned from the park to the motocross park. I mean, was it just like eye-opening, like, wow, this is the real deal?
Yeah, so, so obviously the park was a little bit of a slower pace, and we would kind of, I would see the same usual people that were sitting on the park benches and the same, old men playing chess type of thing. And, obviously they don't have any of that at the motocross track. They have jumps and turns and stuff like that. So it was a little bit of an adjustment. But I was still fairly young. I think I was maybe 5 or 6. So, for me, it was just, and anytime I was on my dirt bike, I was having a good time.
So learning how to ride at age 4, this must have been a great bonding mechanism between you and your dad. I mean, it's cool to hang out with your dad. He's the rock of your world at that age, and hopefully still is, but also the fact that you're doing something that every kid loves to do before you even learn how to ride a bike, right? You learn how to ride a motorcycle.
Yeah.
And here you are, looking up to your dad. He's on probably a big bike, a 250 or 400 or something like that, tooling down the road, and you're like, wow, that's me. Yeah. Down the road, not too far away.
Yeah, so, it was definitely a good bonding experience. I mean, like I said, my dad at the time was big into jet skis, and so... I would ride the bike through the park, and he would kind of chase me on the bicycle or the mountain bike, and it kind of worked for the both of us. I was learning how to ride the dirt bike, and he was having to keep up, and that was a good, workout for him. And we did that for, a couple of years, and it was just something that I looked forward to every day after school. I would tell him, like, come on, let's go to the park, let's go ride. And, we just kind of took it from there.
So you can totally relate to this. When I was a kid, I had a mini bike. I didn't have a 50, PW50. I had a mini bike probably at, I don't want my son to hear this, but probably around his age. And there were three words that I always said, whether it was related to my bicycle or my mini bike, to my sisters and my friends: wanna go riding. It wasn't riding, it was riding. R-I-D-D-I-N.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And you can relate because it was such a fun thing to do. It was the ultimate freedom before you even knew what freedom was.
Yeah.
What the word meant,
I mean, like, I tell people all the time, I'm like, I, I can understand how somebody wouldn't want their, you know, son or daughter to get into the sport because it's got its positives and negatives, and, you know, depending on how you look at
it's a big risk factor.
Yeah, exactly. So the negatives can outweigh, but at the same time,
you can get carpal tunnel playing with your digital devices.
Yeah, you could get hurt, you know, just crossing the street in the city. I mean, so for me, it's one of those things where I'd rather take the risk doing something that I know I'm going to, you know, enjoy. Even to this day, I've been riding for 20 years, and I tell my brother all the time, I'm like, I can't wait till we get back on the track. Like, it's just the more I go, the more fun I have.
Does he race as well?
Yeah, he's actually going to Tennessee tomorrow night.
And how old is he?
He's 18, so he just qualified for a big national. So I like to take credit that I kind of helped him get there a little bit.
I'm sure you did.
You know, he's with the support of my dad and stuff, they're going down there, and we'll see what he could do.
All the best to him. Max Gomez, was there ever a point when you're riding down a track or laying there right before you'd fall asleep at night in your bed saying to yourself, I want to be a professional motocross racer?
You know, it was always a dream kind of growing up. My parents and more specifically my dad, we always were realistic where school came first, and that was, you know, the route that ultimately I knew I was going to take. But, you know, growing up watching these guys on TV, it's hard not to want to be that guy that's shooting over a, you know, an 80-foot jump with the lights and the fans and everything. And
80 feet in the air.
Yeah,
wow.
there's some big jumps out there, and it seems like every year with the bikes progressing, the tracks just get more and more gnarly, and the guys are going faster.
So through all those experiences on the track and off the track, being a spectator when you weren't racing, did you ever see an accident or a near miss or a fatality that made you say, "Whoa, think twice about actually participating"?
Oh yeah, on a regular basis. I mean, you even just go to a local track, there's bound to be, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's just the part of the sport that, you know, there's bound to be at least one wreck that's kind of, you know, you don't even want to watch, but that's just part of the sport. And, you know, I haven't always been this way, but within the last couple of years I've been very cautious, and, you know, I don't ride so over my head.
So you toned down your aggressiveness?
Yeah. This injury kind of changed, you know, the way I ride the bike and the way I am on the bike. But, you know, it's something that anything could go wrong. I mean, I've had points in you know, previous times at the track where the bike has shut off in the air.
Whether it's
a mechanical issue or whatever it may be.
So does that change your trajectory or no, because you're already airborne?
Yeah. So
it does.
Yeah. So once the bike shuts off, the wheel locks up, and that just, the gyro, you just start going over. And I went all the way over, and I landed right on my back. The bike landed on me. I broke my femur. And
this is the accident.
No.
That's something else.
I was 15. So this was 2010, and I was at a track in Connecticut.
Three years before.
And they airlifted me out of the track in a helicopter. So it's cool. I could say I rode in a helicopter, but unfortunately, it was you know, because of an accident. But
so when that happens with all that protective gear on, obviously with all the noise that surrounds you, the stadium noise, the cheers, and with that helmet being so tight to your head, could you actually hear it first or feel the vibration cut off before you realize that your motor was killed?
Yeah, no, I knew right away. I mean, that specific day we were doing some testing with ignitions on the bike, and the signs were there. It just, the bike had cut out earlier in the day, and it didn't feel right. But then we made some changes, and I thought, okay, like, you know, I feel okay. And so I just went and did a moto, and I was midway through.
What's
the
moto?
Just like a sprint, I guess you could say, like a typical. I used to do maybe 10-15 minute. They're timed, so usually that's how you'll train. But I was maybe 7 minutes in, and I was coming up to a big jump. I was feeling good, and just maybe about midway up the jump, it just cut out. And then, you know, that's any moto guy will know that's a recipe for disaster. So
in a in a perfect crash situation, if one could exist, is it best to get rid of the bike, or do you want to stay with a bike for protection to land?
It's usually the golden rule. You'll watch some of the top pros when they crash. No matter what, they hold on to the bike because there's a chance. There's always a chance you can save it. And you know,
wait, save the bike?
Save the crash.
Oh.
Like, so they, you'll see them.
You mean prevent the crash.
Yes, exactly. So you'll see them, you know, sometimes hanging off the bike, but the only thing they have on is their hands because, you know, there's always that chance. And then also
that gravity or.
Yeah, whatever it may be, whether you could get on the gas and maybe it, the bike will correct itself. I mean, there's little techniques, but rarely do you want to let it go.
And you can't train for something like that.
No, that's kind of like one of those things that you got to just crash over the years and you learn how to crash. So
get good at crashing.
Yeah, exactly right. But I usually you don't typically want to let go of the bike because that thing weighs over 200 pounds. And, you know, if you're under it, like in my case, I was under it. So, you know, I got the worst end of the stick. But
so let's talk about that day. 2012, you're in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
At a pretty big event. And you're pretty stoked. You're feeling good. You're physically fit, mentally spot on. And take us through that. We're going to roll some video in a few minutes, but I want to hear your explanation of it first, because so this way people can get an idea of how you are, what it feels like to be on a bike before you saw that. Was it a 50 foot?
Yeah, probably somewhere
ish,
around there.
50 foot ish jump that put you into a whole nother stratosphere in your life.
Yeah. So, like you said, Mark, it was a great day leading up to the accident. I was feeling good. I specifically remember pretty much everything that happened that day. I remember that when I woke up, first thing I did in the morning was I went for a run just to kind of get loosened up a little bit. And, you know, at the time, it was just a normal run. But, you know, little did I know that would be one of my last, you know, runs on two legs. So, you know, the rest of the day, the beginning was going well. I went through, you know, in practice, I felt good. And I felt like I was one of the top guys there, and at least in my class. And so I went out for the first race, and you know, I got a good start. I was up in maybe third or fourth, and then I made a pass, and I think I finished second overall. The next race came up. I think I won that one, and I was just kind of getting in a good groove.
So is that typical to have multiple races in one day?
Yes. So in a typical, so this particular event was. I was racing three separate classes. Each class has three motos. This was over the course of 2 days. So this was the Saturday. So there was going to be four races that day and two Sunday.
When you say class, is it different size bikes?
Yeah, different size bikes, age groups. Most people don't typically race three. Usually it's two, but I just figured the more gate time I could get on, you know, the better. So,
gate time is track time?
Yes, exactly right. So so it was about the third or fourth race of the day. And I think, you know, I didn't get such a good start. And so I was kind of mid-pack. I was working my way up, but this race was fairly short. So I think it was like maybe four laps, and there was like, it was probably like maybe a 2 minute lap time, maybe a little less. So it was maybe around an 8 minute race. So it was probably the third lap. And
what's your typical speed, Max? Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's okay. So you can get certain tracks. I mean, now I'm on a bigger bike than I was when I crashed, but you can get up to 50, 60 miles per hour.
So you're pinning it, slowing it down, pinning it, slowing down.
Yeah, the braking power is tremendous on those bikes. They could pretty much stop on a dime. So you'll go from 60 to maybe 10, 15 in you know, a couple seconds.
Wow.
So the
that takes a toll on you physically.
Yes.
Not only do the jumps take a toll on you, but the actual slowing down process is everything's leaning forward and lurching.
You got to have a strong core, which is one
huge
of the things that people don't, you know, really anticipate when you ride, is the core is tremendous. You got to be able to keep the bike upright as well as yourself from, you know, smacking forward and back. So you got to kind of keep tight in that position.
And your muscles, upper body strength has to be obviously.
Yeah. Upper body, lower body, legs.
All over. Top physical condition. Cardiovascularly, muscularly.
So at the time I felt pretty good in terms of, you know, my body and my fitness. So four laps for me was nothing, and I was making passes about midway through. So I came up to this specific jump. It was a step-up jump. So you would jump on, basically to, like, the top of a mountain. And usually they typically water the tracks a little bit if they get a little dusty, just to keep the dust down.
So it's better visibility-wise?
Yeah, exactly right. So they watered the track a little bit prior to my race. So I knew, I knew the track was a little wet, but I guess this specific jump, it kind of caught me in a way that I didn't, anticipate. So I was starting to slide a little bit, and I'm coming up to the jump, and this specific jump wasn't one that you wanted to come up short because the landing was aggressive.
When you mean come up short, you mean distance-wise?
Yes. So I, in my mind, coming up to this jump, I knew I wasn't going to get all the way over.
Because you weren't going fast enough.
Yeah, I was starting to lose traction with the, the wet surface, and I'm coming up to it, and I just kind of hammered the throttle because I knew, let me just give it everything it's got. I'm not going to be able to make it. And I think, hammering the gas made me actually lose even more traction because then that wheel's spinning even faster. And then, so, I'm coming up to it. I just come a little bit short, just enough to kick me. And rather than kicking me forward, I kind of went off to the left. And the bike made it clean to the top of the jump. I went left, and the off to the left was about a 30-foot drop. And I landed right on my feet, or my foot, I should say. But, just the impact from that high up was just shattered all the bones, all the arteries. Everything was a mess in there, which I didn't know at the time. I anticipated maybe a sprained ankle. So I'm sitting there on the side of the track. I take my helmet off, and honestly, I was more aggravated that, just that I was doing so well that day and I just threw it all away just like that, that I was just like, I can't believe it. Like, I've been training for this race for months and how could I make a mistake like that? And then, my dad, he runs over from outside the track and he's like, yeah, all right, like, let's get you out of here. So we went back to the motorhome and eventually we went to the medic. They took the boot off.
How much pain were you in?
I was in quite a bit of pain. I think it was I still had that shock, so it didn't fully set in, but it was painful. But I had never really had any ankle sprains or foot, anything really too bad with the
besides foot, being foot-wise. Airlifted a few years off a track.
Exactly. But in terms of the ankle, I didn't really know what to expect. So
how high does the boot come up to?
So right up below the knee. So, and it's a sturdy boot.
And it's like a ski boot, right?
Yeah.
But much higher?
Yeah.
So it can withstand a great deal of force?
Yeah. Yeah, those boots are, the boots are $600. So they're, they're no joke. And, I couldn't have had any more protective gear than what I had that day. Nothing was going to prevent it. So I went to the medic, and he took the boot off, and he's looking at it. It wasn't even black and blue, was barely swollen. He's like, I was like, if it doesn't hurt, I think you could maybe ride tomorrow. You might be okay. And, in my mind, I'm
music
like,
to your
right,
ears.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
great. Like,
rock
hopefully,
on.
He's yeah. the doctor. You want to believe what he says. So I was like, all right, cool.
Give me some ice.
Yeah, exactly. So we iced it up. I went back to the motorhome, and I just could not find a comfortable position to lay in. Usually I'll sleep it off and just kind of get some rest, and I was hoping I'd be able to race the next day. And there was nothing I could do, like no position, nothing. So I told my dad, I'm like, listen, I think it's a little worse than what we thought. So we went back over to the medic, and he's like, all right, well, they gave me an IV, and they hooked me up, and they were like, let's go, we'll just bring you to the hospital. So it took a 40-minute drive, and we went over to the hospital.
And we're going to take a break now to look at this video that you just described so well. This is Max Gomez in year 2012 in Pennsylvania on his last jump with two of your own feet.
Yeah. I was going to make a pass for third up a jump. Went a little bit sideways. Came just a little bit short on the jump. Flew over the handlebars. The drop was about maybe 15 feet.
All I see is the kid third coming around. Then I see another kid done fourth. Then I knew that there was a problem.
I laid down for about an hour, and I just couldn't get comfortable. There was something about this injury that was different.
Man, just the mental ramifications of that alone. Was that your father filming this?
So it wasn't my dad actually filming it, but that was him speaking.
Sure.
It was one of those things that, you know, you can't anticipate something like that to happen, but, you know.
How long after the accident did you actually see the footage?
So it was maybe, I want to say, like a couple months after that. I mean,
when you saw that footage, and we're going to get to the whole process, we actually only have about 5 more minutes left. How much did that set you back mentally when you saw that?
Well, it's one of those things that you just got to kind of, you know, you look ahead and you just kind of keep moving forward. And I don't like to dwell on the past. I mean, I had months after the accident, I had people coming up to me and saying like, "Hey, like I was there. I saw the crash. How you feeling?" And I would usually just be like, "No, I'm okay." Like that was it.
Sure.
I just kind of kept it.
But Max, I imagine those, you know, weeks you spent in the hospital and at home recuperating, convalescing, that you had this story that you concocted, that, you know, you every second, you know, you're up on there, you feel the wheel spin, you realize, okay, it's not going to work. And so to have the story play out in your head and then to actually see that video must have been either coincided with what you thought happened, or it just said, well, that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably more the latter person, where I just kind of that's how the cards
accept
fell
it, and move on.
Yeah.
So you're at the hospital, and within a day or so, your foot starts to get gangrene.
Yeah.
And the options presented to you were,
So it was either keep the foot or, you know, amputate. And for me, it was kind of a no-brainer. After 2 or 3 weeks that I was in there, it was just the foot. I couldn't even move the toes. You know, the toes were blue, and it was just one of those things where it's like, all right, you could keep it, but you're going to end up being back in here for it anyway. And, you know, to put it bluntly, but at this point, you know, we decided as a family that was really the only option.
When you heard the word amputate, I'm not sure if the doctor actually used that word, but he probably did. Did it just totally rock your world? Did you hear anything else after he said that word, or it's something you and your father, maybe your family, kind of anticipated?
No. So there was no anticipation of that. You know, like I said, I originally went into the hospital thinking maybe a broken foot or ankle. It was kind of like a foreign language to me hearing that, you know, that I didn't know what it, you know, what that entailed. I knew that my life was going to be completely different, but I didn't know, how does the foot stay on? How am I going to walk? Do I shower?
How are you going to ride
it?
A motorcycle?
Yeah. That was probably the last thought, but that was in there somewhere too.
Girl's going to want to date a guy
for
their prosthesis.
I mean, that's definitely a thought too. You know, I remember telling my dad, I'm like, am I going to be like a freak now? Like, I'm going to have one leg. Like, how does this, I don't know anything. I didn't know
all
anything.
All rational thoughts.
Yeah. So, you know,
but
of course,
once you stop and think about it, you probably realize, wow, there's so many people in this world, incredible athletes, scientists, you know, human beings that are just do incredible feats every day with disabilities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And even in my case, I consider what I have to be, you know, the best of a bad situation. I know, you know, I have friends who missing arms, paralyzed, like that's a whole another animal, and they handle it. You know, it's just one of those things that it's a mental.
It's just part of you. It is who you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't define you, but it makes you, you know, your difference makes you stronger. That's my mantra.
Yeah.
When I speak, my difference makes me stronger. So talk about deciding to have the amputation, getting fitted for a prosthetic leg, and then realizing, all right, well, I can walk around, so why can't I get back on the bike?
So believe it or not, it was within a couple weeks of having the amputation, I was already had the thought of getting back on the bike, was kind of bouncing around in my head. And, you know, I didn't expect to be where I am now with the bike, but I just wanted to get back on and show that I could do it. And
it's part of you.
Yeah.
It's an extension of you, rather.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, riding's in my blood, and it's just something that I looked at as a challenge that I knew I would figure out one way or another. And, you know, obviously with my dad's help, we were able to fix up, rig up a bike that, you know, I'm comfortable on. And, you know, from here, it's been, you know, the last couple of years, I've been feeling great on the bike.
And you're left-handed, and we should explain this to people that when you are on a motorcycle, your right hand's working the throttle,
yep.
And then your right hand's also working the rear brake. I'm sorry, the front brake.
Yes.
And your right leg works, it's on a peg, and it works the right brake. Right brake. Your left foot works the, it's on a peg, and it works the gears.
Yes.
And your left arm works the clutch.
Yep.
So, after this accident, you know, you had some things customized, and you decide to actually take that brake, which you tried to ride, but the sense of your sensitivity was diminished.
Right.
So you were braking obviously too aggressively,
yeah.
I imagine.
Yep.
So the fact that you can actually have it re-engineered to have a dual a clutch and brake on the left side was pretty ingenious.
Yeah. So with the help of, you know, my dad was really the one who took the reins on that one. But he, you know, he rigged up this little, you know, this clutch brake mechanism. So typically when I'm coming into a turn, I'll use, you know, my left hand, I'll brake hard. And then I have this recluse clutch in my bike that doesn't allow the bike to shut off. So I can be on the brakes hard enough to slow the bike down, and then, you know, I clutch coming out. It was a little hard to get used to at first, but I knew it was going to be the best way. And, you know, now I wouldn't even put the foot brake on if I could.
Describe the feeling. Was it a feeling of being defeated? Was it a feeling of ambivalence or elation when you got back on the bike again?
I mean, it was just the, you know, for a little while it was tough because I didn't feel very comfortable on the bike. I mean, I was happy to say that I at least got the monkey off my back and I was able to get back on, but I just didn't feel as comfortable as I wanted to. But you know, that was to be expected, and I knew we were going to have to make some changes, and it probably maybe a year or so after the, you know, the first time I got on the bike, it was when I really started to feel good, and we had a good setup. And then, you know, at that point, I knew the bike is as good as it's going to get. The rest is on me.
And the kind of, there's no looking back. You were in X Games after that.
Yeah, I was in, so the Summer X Games of 2013, that was an awesome experience.
I mean, did you ever say to yourself when you were at the gate, like, wow, I mean, look at all that I've overcome, and here I am. You may not have even gotten there possibly without your accident.
Yeah.
Maybe you were training differently. Maybe you were working harder. But, you know, all the chips kind of fell into place for you.
Yeah. So that year, 2013, was an overwhelming year in a good way. There was a lot of good stuff happening. And, yeah, it was definitely something that was really where I started to see, like, wow, this isn't really much of a negative. Like, I could really turn this around to be a positive for myself. And from there, you know, from that year on, I just try to keep the ball rolling.
And of course, you graduated high school, went to college, and you're pursuing a degree, working towards ultimately a biology major right now to become a physical therapist. And you had incredible experience with your prosthetist. That's the person, obviously, that fitted you for a prosthetic leg. And he became one of your sponsors.
Yeah. Prosthetic and orthotics in Miami. There it's Adam Finiston. He's one of my best friends, a great guy. And, you know, he takes great care of me, and anything that I need, I know I can go to him. And, you know, obviously the trip to Florida is a little far, but, you know, we talk on a pretty regular basis, and he's always, you know, helped me out better than,
yeah.
than
I mean,
anything.
The relationship, I mean, between someone and a prosthetist, it's legal, by the way, is unlike anything else, because they're the difference between the doctor getting you there and keeping you alive, but they're the difference between making you ambulatory and then making you Max Gomez again. Max, thank you so much for your time. All your incredible hard work, your desire to remain who you are, what you love in life, and a setback is a setback. And it's not keeping you on the sidelines of life, and that must make you extremely happy.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me.
And to your father, it's a big testament to your father and your brother and your family as a collective unit to work as one and be healthy and help you propel yourself forward.
Absolutely.
So my name is Mark Farrell. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com on overcoming adversity, anti-bullying, self-entitlement, drugs and alcohol, mental health, and more. Markfarrellmotivation.com. Special thanks to Max Gomez and to Michelle Leonard for Soul Stational this week happening in Bayville, New Jersey. Absolutely free. Special thanks to our producer, Luke. Luke Farrell. Say hello, Luke.
Hello.
That's it from New York City. Have a great week. See you next Thursday. Bye-bye.